For the week of February 8th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 268, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And on the road to Los Angeles, goodbye, New York. Goodbye, Showbiz Sandbox, for that matter. I'm out of here, suckers. I'm Michael Giltz.
Wait, what are you talking about?
Did you not see the news?
I apparently did not see the news.
There is a sequel to Neighbors, a film by Seth Rogen and my buddy Zac Efron. You know, they starred in it, and there's a sequel, Neighbors 2. It was in the Variety and Hollywood Reporter. And of course, in the sequel, what's the sequel to Neighbors? It is a sorority movie next door. Neighbors was about a fraternity movie next door, and Neighbors 2 is about a sorority moving in next door. Who pitched that idea?
I believe it was you. You know what?
It was me on this show. Everybody heard it clearly. And now, to be honest, I wasn't mentioned in the story, but obviously it's my pitch idea. They must want to make the movie with me, and I'm out of here. I'm headed to L.A. Can I crash on your couch?
Yeah, actually. I believe it's a pullout. Yes.
Great. So this is it. I'm set. Finally, I've had a movie pitch be accepted by Hollywood.
Well, wait a second. You're just coming out here to meet with your lawyers, right? For the lawsuit that's inevitable? No?
Well, yeah, maybe that's true. But until I meet with my lawyers, well, I guess we should do the show anyway. What will we talk about?
Well, on this week's show, of course, we're going to be discussing the Grammy Awards. They were held last night to honor the year's best music. David Wilde, he's a contributing editor over at Rolling Stone magazine. He does so many jobs. He's one of the producers and one of the writers of the Grammy Awards telecast. He will be joining us to tell us about how this year's show was put together. And really, I mean, there were some great moments in this year's telecast, so I personally look forward to speaking with David. Now, speaking of awards, the Directors Guild of America handed out its award for best direction, I guess, for movies and television shows over the past year. They did that over the weekend. Unfortunately, that didn't seem to clear up the Oscar race at all, since Birdman won the DGA award.
Unfortunately, who wants it cleared up? I want some suspense.
Oh, okay. Well, then you're going to get it. Birdman wins DGA, and guess what? Next evening in London, Boyhood took home the BAFTA award for best film. So they seem to be in a neck-and-neck race, Birdman and Boyhood. Now, when it rains, it pours. We've got more news about the Sony cyber attack, or at least more news about the fallout from it. There's also news on net neutrality. Looks like Tom Wheeler, the head of the FCC, may not be so bad after all. Or is he? Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Before I do, let me ask you a question, a serious question. Who, Sperling, who lives in a pineapple under the sea?
Well, the last time I had a sea pineapple, I don't know.
SpongeBob SquarePants, the number one movie around the world. And of course, we're talking about worldwide box office, not just North America. We look at RentTrack. We have a link to their documents in our show notes. We listen to Variety and the Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, anywhere we can find information. And everybody agrees the number one movie around the world is the much anticipated sequel to the first SpongeBob movie. It's SpongeBob SquarePants 2. What is it called? I actually forget the full title.
I thought it was SpongeBob SquarePants,
Sponge Out of Water. Okay. The SpongeBob movie, Sponge Out of Water, which is dangerous if you're a sponge. It grossed $72 million worldwide. It's at $84 million and counting. It cost about $70 million to make. So that's a heck of a good start for this movie. At number two around the world is a less exciting start. That is Jupiter Ascending. That's the new film by the Wachowski siblings. It grossed $51 million worldwide. It cost a lot of money to make. The reviews were awful. Everybody thinks it's dead in the water, but $50 million is an okay start. If it can have a 10 multiplier, meaning it grosses 10 times as much as it made its opening weekend, and that is pretty rare indeed, well, then maybe it can get to profitability.
Yeah, well, good luck.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. At number three is American Sniper, which is truly a phenomenally successful film in North America. The Clint Eastwood-directed film grossed another $30 million. It's at $360 million worldwide. It's starting to build up serious coin overseas, where it's grossed $80 million. But in North America, it's just unstoppable. It's about to pass the $300 million mark. It's one of the most successful R-rated films of all time, one of the most successful war films of all time, the biggest hit of Clint Eastwood's career is what it looks like.
Well, and a Clint Eastwood movie that he's not starring in.
Yeah, biggest hit as a director or an actor, frankly.
Yes.
So this is, of course, not adjusted for inflation, as Sterling would like to say.
I was just going to ask that.
Big accomplishment for Clint Eastwood. At number four is Taken 3, the Liam Neeson film. Another $13 million. That's going to pass the $300 million mark worldwide. And at number five, Disney's Big Hero 6 clawed its way to profitability. It passed the $500 million mark worldwide, thanks to Japan, where this sort of Japanese-influenced story has proven very popular indeed.
I can't imagine why Big Hero 6 would be so popular in Japan.
At number six is The Imitation Game. And let's talk about this for a second. It grossed another $10 million. It's at $150 million worldwide. But look at it in North America. It's just past the $75 million mark. This movie is probably going to get to like $90 or $100 million. That is ridiculous in North America. That is pure Weinstein, don't you think?
That is. Well, and it's pure award season. Not hype, but it's partly due to the award season is what I'm trying to say.
There is no reason this movie should have grossed $100 million in North America. I don't care how good or bad you think it is. That's just crazy numbers. And that's purely by them platforming it the right way, getting it there in the award season talk. It's, of course, winning some awards, getting it new news attention by various gambits that they've pulled, some positive, some sort of tacky. But this is just the Weinstein playbook to turn a movie that people would have been happy if it made $25 or $30 million in North America. Somebody else would have been like, hey, good success. You know, it's a film about a British gay man in World War II helping, you know, break a code. And this is about to hit $100 million in the U.S. That is crazy. That is just the genius of the Weinsteins as far as marketing is concerned.
Well, you know, I always say coming out of festivals such as Sundance and Cannes that sometimes picking your distributor when you're being acquired, if you're a producer with a film and it's out there being acquired, sometimes picking your distributor is very important.
Distributors, sometimes, it's always.
Well, yeah, I mean, distributors who know how to release a film like The Imitation Game, it's important.
Right, and of course, if you want final cut, stay away from them.
Well, you'll get cut, just not final cut.
At number seven is The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies. $940 million is where that's at worldwide. It probably will fall a little bit short of $1 billion, but a big finale for that series. At number eight, Night at the Museum, $325 million. At number nine, another big flop, really, Seventh Son, which sat on the shelf, I think, for several years in North before it was released worldwide. I don't know. I don't see a budget here, but I think it cost a substantial amount of money. This stars Jeff Bridges.
Yes. And Julianne, I think, Julia Moore. Yes.
That's right. It grossed $8 million over the weekend. It's at $65 million worldwide, but it's far away from profitability and looks to be pretty much dead in the water. Looking down the list for something new, there's a couple new films that are on our list. Crazy New Year's Eve. It's a Chinese romantic drama. It grossed $5.5 million. It opened in China only, I assume. It is directed by, or code, it seems to have four directors. So I think I'm assuming it's four different stories, maybe melded together. I don't know whether it's one of those.
Or maybe it's like, you know, in Hollywood, they have like 500 writers on a film. Maybe in China, they have 500 directors on a film.
Well, you know, the Chinese New Year is February 19th. That's just a few days after the Stevie Wonder special airs on CBS, which we'll be talking about with David Wild, because he's working on that now that the Grammys are over. So the Chinese New Year is February 19th. It's the year of the goat, in case you were wondering. So this movie is set, I want to say February 18th, but it's a little confusing. There seems to be sometimes a gap between the end of one year and there's like 5 or 8 or 10 or 12 days of festivities before the new year begins. I'm a little confused about that, but I think this movie is set on what would be February 18th in our calendar. So that's what the movie's about. It's a family sort of drama, a comedy. One of the four directors listed is Eva Jin, and she is the most commercially successful female director in China's history. And she's known for turning romantic comedies into big box office. So that's kind of cool and notable that she has this growing reputation as a very successful female director, probably knocking down barriers for people. But do we say it's set right around Chinese New Year? That's the big question, Sperling.
Oh, you mean instead of, say, the Roman calendar? Or is it the, yeah, it's the Roman
calendar.
No,
it's Koreans and Thai and Vietnamese also celebrate it, but they don't call it the Chinese New Year. They call it the Lunar New Year. And they say, hey, it's not their festival. It's not their holiday. We all celebrate it. Unfortunately, there's like a billion Chinese people, and they sort of established that in the popular imagination as the Chinese New Year. So there is a question, if you want to be politically correct or sensitive to other cultures, how to refer to the holiday that they're celebrating. Since it's a Chinese film and it's directed by a Chinese director, and it's in the Chinese territory. For today, we'll call it Chinese New Year's Eve.
Okay. My goodness. That was a long way. That was a long walk for a very short leap.
Well, you know, it's interesting about to spotlight a female director and to talk about the Chinese New Year.
Okay.
And another movie, C'est Bon.
Don't right? you mean C'est Bon?
Right, exactly. So I assume it was French. Well, it's not.
No.
I looked it up. It's actually a Korean biopic. And it is about, it grossed $4.5 million over the weekend. It opened in South Korea. And again, somebody let me know, is it preferable to say Korean or should you always say South Korean? I'm wondering.
I don't know. Write to us.
How they feel about that. Yeah.
Write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263.
That's right. And this is a South Korean musical biopic about a popular folk group called Twin Folio. They were big in the 60s through the 80s, and they became famous. They got their start at the music hall in South Korea known as C'est Bon. However, I don't know whether they're like the Weavers or Peter, Paul, and Mary or who to compare them to, but I think they were a duo, but in the movie, they're a trio. So I'm not sure whether they just decided to add someone or maybe someone was part of the group and then fell away right before success happened. So try as I might to figure out the story behind Twin Folio, I wasn't able to do so. But their songs are on YouTube and the movie is out in theaters right now in South Korea. And then there's another movie right below that where I also got confused. It's called An Inspector Calls and it grossed $3.9 million. It's a Hong Kong action comedy, which I assume has nothing to do with the J.B. Priestley play An Inspector Calls.
Ah, okay.
And yet it is based on the play An Inspector Calls by J.B. Priestley. I don't know how you make an action comedy in Hong Kong and claim it's based on the J.B. Priestley play, but it is, and it's there, so there you go.
Well, I think we all know next weekend we're going to be talking about probably 50 Shades of Grey, which opens here in the United States.
That's right, and ouch!
What?
Apparently, the 50 Shades of Grey lubricant doesn't work so well.
You know what? Hey, Michael, what happens behind closed doors?
Action lawsuit filed by a woman who claimed, hey, they advertised this and made it sound like an aphrodisiac. And you know what? I didn't really feel much. So she also says they didn't get the proper clearance to claim it's compatible with condoms and other devices. So who knows? The timing of it makes it suspicious. It's nothing connected to the film. It's product that's been out for a few years connected to the books. The filmmakers and those people happily do not have to deal with this. So it's nothing to do with them. But you did say that it's important to know who your distributor is. And that's certainly true for Quentin Tarantino, isn't it?
Yeah, you see, that's what I'm talking about. I didn't even know you had posted this story here in the show notes about Quentin Tarantino. Tino, he wants to, of course, he's the big director. I don't have to explain that, right? I mean, people listening to, okay. Well, he wants to personally approve every single distributor that buys his new Western. He's shooting it right now, Hateful Eight. The Weinstein Company, I guess they were trying to experiment and maybe thinking of a worldwide VOD deal with Netflix, but they decided against it. And by decided against it, Quentin Tarantino said, absolutely over my dead.
Did he? Did he?
I'm sure that that's Tarantino, Mr. 35 millimeter film. I hate digital. Yeah, I think he owns a movie theater for Pete's sake. Yeah, I think it was probably his doing.
Interesting, because he is insisting that people who buy his movie must show it in 70 millimeter to begin. So wherever you are in the world, you have to do something somewhere. One theater debuted the film on 70 millimeter. Then he wants it shown in 35 millimeter.
So
it's
he's requesting.
There aren't that many theaters left showing celluloid.
Well, and I guess what he's referring to is that every distributor around the world shows it in 70 millimeter.
That's what I said.
Yeah, the problem there is that not only you mentioned there aren't that many theaters showing 35 millimeter prints anymore, there are even fewer showing 70 millimeter prints. I mean, you can really start to begin counting them on your fingers.
I know Ebert Fest, the Roger Ebert Film Festival in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, is hosted in a theater that is one of the few remaining theaters in the country that can show 70 millimeter film properly.
Right.
So there are not many of them at all.
I have a colleague who had all of these 70 millimeter sound heads and they were being thrown away. And he said, you know what, maybe I should save these just in case. And sure enough, now between Tarantino and Christopher Nolan, he's actually found a lot of use for them. And there's been a lot of call for them because there's really, I think there were like 10 of them that he saved, and they're the last remaining six track Soundheads, at least in the U.S.
I hope he's renting them out.
I think it, you know, he did it for his company, but he took them home to his apartment for Pete's sake.
So when you talk about Tarantino approving his the buyers of his movie, I don't think it's a sense of him going, "Who are you?" Whatever. He knows these people and he has relationships with them, and he wants to make sure the people taking this movie are the people he likes and feels are passionate about the movie and will do it right.
That's right.
You know, he doesn't want to joke. He's probably going to go for the best top buyer. He's just going to make sure, hey, I want to know you. I want to know what you're doing with my film. You know, the big directors, they have relationships with these people all over the world, don't they?
Well, or they at least know them.
A lot of them, yeah.
Yes.
I mean, that's why they go to NATO. That's why they go to these big events. That's why they go to meet with these people, because they know they're an important part of launching their film.
Well, and they may have actually released previous films that the director made, and they know, right. Well, John Doe distribution will do better than Sally Doe or, you know, yeah. Harry Doe. You know, so they know which distributor handles film properly.
Unquestionably, Hateful Eight will be an awards contender come 2016 or 15, however, you know, the end of the year into next year. So let's look at some of the award contenders this year. We had the DGA Awards, as you said.
That's right. And Alejandro Iñárritu, he took home the top prize from the Directors Guild of America. And yet he's from Mexico. So I don't even know if he's a DGA kind of
well, you
member.
Have to be. You
okay.
Have to be.
Yeah.
Don't you?
I guess so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he took home the top honor for best direction of a feature film for, of course, Birdman.
That's right. When we're tea leaving for the Oscars. So right the next night, what happened at the BAFTAs?
Well, you know, Richard Linklater wasn't at the BAFTAs because he was at the DGAs and he couldn't get there in time. So Ethan Hawke had to accept the award for best film. Boyhood won best film.
That's right. And Grand Budapest Hotel won a lot of other awards. They were complaining. Did the DGA schedule their night in conflict with BAFTA this year compared to past years? Because Stephen Fry slammed the DGAs for not allowing Linklater to show up, as if they purposefully scheduled their evening to conflict with the BAFTAs.
Right. Well, I mean, it won at least three awards, the best film, best director, and best supporting actor.
No, I'm asking. Stephen Fry slammed the DGAs.
I don't know whether they scheduled it in conflict or whether one was scheduled and then the I have no idea. I do know that the Lego Movie won for best animated feature, and Phil Lord, one of the film's directors, said to the crowd gathered there, to the audience, he said, "You are our favorite Academy by far. You guys win the award for Best Academy."
No. Well, sure, they gave him the award. They weren't even nominated for an Oscar.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you know what? I'm convinced now that Birdman will win the Academy Award for Best Picture.
So why? Am I.
Why? Because it's the one that would annoy me the most. I hated this movie. I saw it and I hated it. Hated it. So if the Oscars can frustrate and annoy you, they will, which means I'm now convinced that's the one.
Well, and I know Boyhood frustrates and annoys other people who say, hey, well, it's a thin story, it's kind of a parlor trick, or a...
Well, everybody has its detractors and defenders, but I think Boyhood is generally admired, even if you don't love it. I don't know people who... I think Birdman is more of a love-hate film than Boyhood. Birdman is a lot more polarizing, I would say.
Well, you know, of note, at the DGA, Comedy Series went to Transparent, the Amazon Studios show. So that best direction for that show. And I wonder if the Golden Globe helped it there. It won the Golden Globe for best comedy series.
I don't think the directors say, I wonder who the Golden Globe has voted for.
Okay.
Barnes, all you're doing is wondering what one is doing to the other. None of it matters.
Okay. Well, what about The Imitation Game not winning any awards at the BAFTAs? And of course, it's the most British of stories because it was about Britain breaking the Enigma machine.
Well, that just means that the BAFTAs have some credibility, doesn't it?
Oh, okay.
So they're not just giving all the rewards to films that are British-based, which would be the natural inclination. You know, it's a homegrown film, homegrown talent, right? But Theory of Everything has some British roots, doesn't it?
That's true. In fact, it won the Outstanding British Film Award at the BAFTAs.
Well, there you go.
And of course, as you mentioned, the Grand Budapest Hotel walked off with a whole bunch.
That's right. So perhaps in tech awards, certainly like score and production design and costume, you can expect it to be a strong contender at the Oscars. One person who won't be at the Oscars, Amy Pascal.
Actually, I wouldn't be shocked if she was at the Oscars, but I can guarantee you that the interview, it's not going to be, it's not nominated for anything. And I don't.
Oh, it'll be mentioned.
Oh, it'll be mentioned. Yeah, absolutely. Amy Pascal, you may recall her of the, you know, head of Sony Pictures Entertainment, along with Michael Lynton. She is not going to be
head.
She
was co-head?
Well, I think one was chairman, the other was like president. Yeah, I don't.
No, go ahead. She didn't share her title. She was the head of Sony.
Yeah, she was the.
Let's not downgrade her to like co.
No, but what was her official title? She was the top film executive, whereas Michael Linton kind of oversees more than film, I suppose.
Actually, she was co-chairman of Sony Pictures Entertainment.
Okay, so we've downgraded her, we've upgraded her, we've talked about her in the past.
Did she resign or was she fired?
I think that her contract was up this year. I think that we would have been talking about her contract not being renewed, whether this Sony cyber attack happened or not. Because right. The
contract wasn't renewed. She was fired.
Yeah.
You know, saying she resigned or stepped down. It's like, no. She was fired.
And she was given a, you know, a producer's deal at the studio, which is.
As one is.
Yeah. It's kind of like the consolation. Consolation gift. Yeah. And so, you know.
Suntan lotion from Coppertone and a collection, a year supply of Coppertone suntan lotion and a producing deal.
Pretty much. Yes.
Who will replace her? She's gone. As you say, there's more reasons than the Sony hacking scandal, which was unquestionably poorly handled after it happened. But there was a lot of problems with Sony. She had investors breathing down her throat and bad-mouthing her. She had a series of flops. You know, it was not a great year and a half for her, though she has overall a very strong track record at Sony and great relationships with talent. Nonetheless, it wasn't enough to protect her job, and she's out of there.
Yeah, and we kind of thought that, you know, this is going to be very hard to overcome. But it would be a shame if it was just the Sony cyber attack. Why do I keep calling it the Sony cyber attack? If it was,
I don't know why it. I thought it would take longer though. I thought they would not want to kick her to the curb so soon after it happened. So I was wrong about that. I predicted Japan would wait a while. But I guess since her contract was up, they had no choice.
Well, her contract is up later this year. They could have waited.
But I'm saying they're going to have to make a decision now. By the end of the year, they're going to have to make a decision. Did they want to give her a one-year extension just to save face? Or did they want to just, you know, make clear what they were going to do now if they didn't have confidence in her? Clearly, she was on her way out, and this was the time to do it.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it was kind of big news here, you know, but...
Of course. The head of a studio is gone. And who will replace her? That's the big question.
Well, there's some talk about Tom Rothman, who, you know, formerly of Fox, and he's now the head of TriStar. Michael DeLuca, who for years ran New Line Cinema, and he's now at Sony as president of production. It was a surprising move when he took that job, actually. Everybody thought, well, is that a step down for him? Or why is he, you know... so far down the ladder there, but he's a kind of a veteran, if you will, of the...
Just everybody, tell me who your pick is.
My pick, Jeff Robinoff has been talked about.
You're listing.
I know. I would say...
Who's your best bet? Maybe you don't have one. That's okay.
Tom Rothman or Michael DeLuca. Even though Doug Belgrad, who has worked his way up that studio ladder since 1989, and he's a heck of a guy. He's really nice and very smart and intelligent. I think that they will probably pass him up, not because he's not, smart enough or good enough. It's just that he's always been a guy who's in the trenches, who knows what he's doing, and doesn't have a big...
That'll never get you ahead.
Yeah, it doesn't have a big public persona or presence, whereas Tom Rothman and Michael DeLuca most certainly do.
Yeah, but you know what? If he's good and you name him head, suddenly he's got a big public presence.
For instance, last week, if I had said to you the name, I don't know, Tom Staggs, you
Ooh?
Would have... Exactly. Whereas I had been keeping an eye on Mr. Staggs now for the past two years, probably, because he was the head of Walt Disney Company. It's not Walt Disney Studios. It's the Disney Company. He's the head of their parks and resorts. And he has long been rumored to be one of the on the short list to be taking over for Bob Iger as CEO of the company.
And now it's official.
And now it seems to be official. He has been named the chief operating officer and will take the role as soon as they can find a replacement to take over the parks and resorts.
That's right. So now he was in finance. He was in charge of making deals, contracts, that stuff. He had a great background in finance and deals, and they said he needs more operational experience, so they put him in charge of the parks, which obviously is a huge element of the Disney company. But my thing is, they've now named him the heir apparent when he hasn't had any good track record at the parks. All the stuff he's worked on hasn't borne fruit yet. He's been working on Shanghai Disney, which opens in the spring of 2016. He's been working on the Avatar-themed land. That's going to open in 2017, and obviously has problems because of the movie being delayed. He's been working on something called My Magic Plus, which is a way to deal with overcrowding at the parks. That hasn't really fully formed yet. We haven't been able to make a final decision on whether that's worked out well or not. So you put him over there to get experience. He works on a lot of stuff, but you don't wait to see how it turns out.
Well, a couple points here. First off, I'm going to put a tab in My Magic Plus for a second. He's known as not necessarily an instigator, so he's not initiating these projects, but he's executing them quite well. The execution of Shanghai Disney apparently has gone quite well.
Well, we won't know until it opens.
Well, at least the building of it, okay? So the build-out has been kind of on schedule, under budget. They've got more money than they needed, and it's going well. Same with the Avatar-themed opening, which is in 2017. My Magic Plus, so taking the tab out of that, that has been a huge success. It has been a huge success in Orlando, the only park where it's available, and they are now going to be moving it over to Shanghai Disney and hopefully to Disneyland. One of his big wins was the opening of Cars Land at the California Adventureland at Disneyland. California Adventureland was known as the, why do I have to go to this other park? Why didn't you leave the parking lot there? It would be so much closer to Disneyland. Now I've got to park 5 miles away, get on a bus, and drive all the way here because you wanted to build this California Adventureland thing that I don't even want to go to, and now I've got to pay extra to go into that thing. Nobody wanted to go to it. He turned that park around.
How?
Cars Land was one of the major...
He instigated Cars Land?
He was...
That was open when it barely started there. He's only been there a year and a half.
He saw that through. It was already kind of in the works, and he actually fast-tracked it and got it pushed through and managed the whole thing and managed to oversee the whole thing. And it is amazing. That little section of the park is worth going to California Adventureland for, frankly. And he kind of upgraded a lot of that park, and attendance has increased, I think, 10%. Since he took over, if not more.
So you're a fan.
Well, I agree with you, actually. I reserve judgment because I agree. I think, look, you took over that part of the business, okay? And you're obviously very good at managing purse strings, okay? He's obviously good at that. Everybody says that about him. He's very good when it comes to public speaking, and everybody likes him, and he's very affable, and he's got a good personality, which are all the things you need in a CEO, especially a CEO of a big media company. The problem and the issue is, look at who you have right now. You got Bob Iger. What did he do? He spent he was originally in finance, but he spent years at ABC learning the creative side and working on the creative side, and he worked his way into the kind of being the CEO of a media company. As opposed to a parks and recreation.
Numbers guy.
Yes. And sometimes when you get numbers guys and creative positions, it can be a disaster. So, mind you, the other person that was up for this job was the CFO, Jay Rusulo, or Russ Rasulo, of Disney. He was passed over, obviously. Frankly, he's done a great job at Disney, and it would be a shame to see him leave. And being the CFO at Disney.
Well, he's going to leave.
Yeah, it's his contract is up. Whereas Tom Stagg's contract ends when, apparently, Iger retires. So there's some convenient timing there. Right now, actually, his contract ended. Jay Rasulo's contract ended on January 31st. So he's kind of at will. Right now, he's at will. He could leave at any moment.
I guess Stags took over in parks in January of 2010.
Yes, and of course he had worked.
So that's a while. So Cars Land launched in June of 2012. So he was certainly, even if it had started before then, he was certainly involved in the last 2 years of it before it opened. So that's certainly significant. So all credit to him for that then.
Yeah, and I think if I'm not mistaken, and I can't remember if I'm recalling this correctly, Jay Rasulo was.
He was hired at Parks.
Yeah. So basically Jay Rasulo moved up
he
to
started
CFO.
It and Stags gets to end it.
Exactly. Much like over at Sony, you got Amy Pascal, who's probably, if she would have stayed on, would have had a great year. She's got a couple things coming out this year. Well, she used to. James Bond sequel, Spectre, is coming out. Mm-hmm. And the Ghostbusters, reboot.
Well, that hasn't even begun yet.
In 2016. So yeah, I mean.
Yeah. That's a year and a half away before it opens if it stays on track. I mean, that's, I wouldn't, that's an idea on paper.
Okay.
It's a perfectly reasonable thing, but I wouldn't say, oh, she got screwed because that Ghostbusters reboot, you know, it's not even finished casting yet. They don't even have a script as far as I know.
Well, isn't that what you're coming out for?
That's right. That's a different script. Well, yeah. So there you go. You know, you have to see how Tom Staggs does. He's got a long time to keep learning. He'll stay in charge of parks, right, until they get a new head. And then he becomes the COO.
Yes.
So we'll have to see where he ends up. Congrats to him. I guess that's one more job we didn't get.
Yes, that's true. Although I was expecting this to be announced sometime, probably April, May timeframe. This comes a little early. A lot of the insiders I speak to at Disney who are pretty, they're close to Iger. Let's put it that way. Literally very close to Iger. You know, work with him regularly.
They should back up a little bit. Show a little personal space.
Exactly.
For God's sake.
They felt like, you know, this is probably going to be an April, May timeframe. But everybody's wondering the same thing, which is, gee, you know, when you took over, Mr. Iger, the stock price was at like what, like $16, $25. Now look at it. It's hitting all time highs. Who are you going to get to follow in your footsteps? Everybody wanted to know, and people were getting a little anxious because they kept extending Iger's contract. Well, not anymore. 2018, he will depart, and Staggs, as of now, will take over as CEO, it looks like.
Well, we know who the new head of the Grammys is. The new king of the Grammys would be Beck, wouldn't it?
Well, I guess, yes.
Of course, one album of the year. I've never understood why they end the show with record and song rather than album. I always think album of the year is the big award, but for some reason that comes towards the end. It's like doing movies and ending with best actor rather than best picture. I don't get it, but that's what they do every year, and Beck won it.
Well, Michael, we promised during our music coverage this week we would be speaking with longtime friend of the show, David Wilde. This has become an annual tradition where every year after the Grammys, we speak to the person that helped write the Grammys and now co-produce the Grammys. This is somebody who is leading the life we all want to live, because when he's not being a contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine, he's off hanging out with friends like Brad Paisley and writing books about them. And I swear, every music documentary that I see, and I see quite a few of them, Michael, as you know, there is David Wilde as one of the people being interviewed. He is one of the, a music expert. David, thank you for joining us, especially since you're actually working on the Stevie Wonder tribute right now, literally right now.
Yeah. We just started rehearsals this morning, and that show's being filmed tomorrow. It airs on CBS. Just like it sort of last year, we did the Beatles salute, the Grammy Beatles salute, and this is a salute to Stevie Wonder. So, yeah, I hope everyone will tune in for that.
Yeah, it must be really hard hanging out with people like Stevie Wonder and Ringo Starr and Paul McCartney. You know, that must be a rough gig.
It's not, but there are crazy moments. Like last night, I was with Stevie backstage, and Sia's performance began, and he asked me, "Can you describe what's going on?" And you tried describing. I love that performance. I thought it was fantastic, but it's not an easy one to paint a word picture for. So I tried my best.
For those who don't know, Sia was nominated for a number of Grammys. She wrote the song Chandelier. She's written many songs. She was a songwriter for the earlier part of her career. She's written songs for, I think, Britney Spears and Rihanna and a number of artists. And now she's a solo performer, a singer. But she doesn't like to have her face shown. She wants the music to stand on its own. So I forwarded Michael, who was in New York, I forwarded him a YouTube clip of that performance. And the next text I get back is, "What was that?" Because he was unfamiliar with that particular, with how she was going to handle the performance. I didn't know she was going to handle the performance that way. She basically...
We knew, but we couldn't tell. And she wanted to keep it a surprise, and we honored that, really.
So she didn't even tell you, as one of the producers of the show?
No, they knew. They knew. Said that.
No, she told us. No, she actually told us in a collaborative. She just did not want us to say Kristen Wiig would be, and Maddie would be basically performing her part. We couldn't announce that. She asked us not to, and we respected that wish, and I thought it was a fascinating and rather artful moment. And Kristen Wiig was great.
And she was great. She Sia faced the wall, sang the song, and Kristen Wiig acted out the and danced with Maddie, the dancer in the music videos, and reenacted the video. And it was one of those interesting Grammy moments that we all live for.
Yeah, I thought it was. I loved it, but it was not easy to explain it to Stevie, but I tried my best.
Let's get the good news out of the way. Kanye West made headlines again. But then there's the bad news, which is the overnights were not great. Grammys hit a 6-year low, but they reached 25.3 million viewers. To put it in context, it'll be the second highest entertainment rated show of the year, I think, after the Oscars. But of course, are you getting the sense that more people are time shifting the show? I mean, there's a lot of live performances, and so the drive is to get people to tune in live. But I think in the world we live in, anytime you see a drop, you can't assume that fewer people watch. It may just be that fewer people are watching later.
Well, I mean, we weren't, for instance, last year, we weren't on opposite The Walking Dead and the premiere of a spinoff of Breaking Bad, which, you know, starred a friend of mine, Bob Odenkirk, and I didn't get to see it, but I'm sure it was great.
Yeah, I mean, it did set a record for the biggest cable debut of all time.
Basic cable.
Yeah, so no, I think that's really what that was the main factor. But I think I speak for everyone, we're happy. I think the Grammys, in the last decade have just had this sort of consistent sort of, I think we've basically gone up as a show in our standing and relevance. I think it's been a great 10 years and, different years bring different challenges. Vince Gilligan was one little challenge. but I think, I think everyone's happy with the show and how it did. And, I think we're all very proud of it.
Well, you say that each year brings different challenges. What were the challenges for you and Ken Ehrlich, I guess he's the technical director and producer. What were the challenges this year for you guys?
I mean, there's just challenges, and there's just, there's the challenges of the ever-changing music industry, which obviously, and the economics of everything. So putting together this kind of show, this kind of scale, it's an incredibly challenge. It's not, and that's Ken Ehrlich really is the one who has to lead that charge, and working with Neil at the Academy, I'm happy to be, be in the room and be helping do my part. But yeah, no, listen, I think, that we're living in a world where there is a lot of award shows, and I think a few stand apart, and I think that's, the Grammys, the Oscars. To me, in the country world, the CMAs, there's just certain sort of gold standard shows, and I'm proud to be a part of it and proud of the show last night very much, and we're in a good mood, but we're basically more focused on doing another show tomorrow.
Well, in years where, like, Avatar in the Oscars, when a big movie is like Avatar is nominated for Best Picture, more people tune in to the Oscars. Is it the same when it comes to the Grammys, like when Adele sells 21 million albums or however many albums she sold? Is that year guaranteed to be a bigger draw than a year where all the albums sold well, but nothing was a huge breakout hit?
Yeah, well, listen, I'll leave it to others to calculate the mathematics. I'm familiar with them in terms of the Oscars and the Grammys. It's just, the challenge of, the music business has changed. And, I mean, how many pop? I happen to love Beck. I love that album. But, there is a reality. We were, in essence, introducing it to the vast majority of the world. So that and I love that performance of Chris Martin. I thought it was sort of like the post-punk Simon and Garfunkel, those two.
So it was Beck and Chris Martin singing a song from Beck's album, which won Album of the Year last night. And I think that surprised a lot of people that Beck's album would win. And there was a little bit of a, I don't want to say controversy. I mean, I guess it was kind of a news.
There's no controversy.
No,
there's
not
no
at
controversy.
All.
It's one of the best albums of the year from an artist who's been one of the signal artists for 10, 15 years now and is well overdue to win.
I'm not referring to the win. I'm talking about Kanye West kind of doing what he did last night by
that's not controversy. That's just him being a fool.
Oh, okay. Well,
I think Kanye West is a genius, and I think he agrees with me. And I love I love those performances. I personally can't remember. Did he actually say who is Beck? I'm not sure. I think he might have been post. I think that's bad form, and I do agree. I think Beck, you know, is a great artist, and I actually love the sort of, and I, you know, I was as surprised as anyone, but like I knew that I was writing and working on something for Prince, but the idea of Prince giving it to Beck was great, because those of us who, you know, Beck had that song Devil where he tried to make imitate in love Prince. I thought that was cool. I actually like, and I think I appreciate Kanye jumping on stage from the point of view that that will be a very, very viewed moment on demand, and I bet you that helped our numbers a whole lot. People are going to be looking back to try to see what the heck happened.
It is one of the lowest selling albums of all time to win Album of the Year, which is kind of interesting. Only two other albums in Grammy history that I can see have won Album of the Year without going gold at some point, as far as I can tell. And that is Quincy Jones' Back on the Block and Herbie Hancock's The Joni Letters. Even going back to the 60s, every album went at least gold, and often they're some of the biggest selling albums of the year. So it is notable that, unlike the Oscars, the Grammys tend to focus on the big hit monster hits, which would have given an edge to Beyonce. But it was also a big night for Sam Smith. And it's kind of inspiring in a way, because nobody's talking about the fact that an openly gay man won Best New Artist, Song of the Year, Record of the Year, and Pop Vocal Album, and joked about his ex-boyfriend breaking his heart. And it's just sort of business as usual in the world of pop music and culture these days.
Yeah, no, I thought that was a nice and positive trend. That he was I got to know him a little bit on this award season, when running around on various shows, and he's a lovely guy. I thought that I loved his speech. I wish I could claim I wrote that part, but I did not.
Hmm.
Well, there are impromptu moments like the one we just mentioned with Kanye that get people watching, as you mentioned. And then there are the moments in years past. It was maybe Pink flying through the auditorium, flying through the Staples Center that got everybody talking. And I would imagine every year it must be hard to top yourself every year. And as the show was going on, I thought, where's the big Pink moment? Where's that big moment that everybody's going to be talking about tomorrow? I've personally thought it was the Sia performance. But for you, was there one performance that you really thought this is going to be the one everybody's talking about? And is there
no,
that?
No, we thought, I mean, yeah. I think that Ken plans it so that there's like about 15 or 20 moments that everyone will talk about. And for instance, like Annie Lennox, she's basically been trending since she took the stage last night. And that's great. She's just like, you know, someone who's been around, it's been a star who's, you know, it's not her first time to the fair. And I thought she just hit it out of the park and reminded people how great she is.
It was very interesting to see the people's expression on their face, the audience's expression. They were kind of in awe of her showing up and singing so well and doing such a great performance with Hozier.
Yeah, no, and then, you know, I mean, having Kanye and Paul and Rihanna sort of, play together, I thought that was a great moment that people were talking about. You know, little things like ELO, you know,
yeah.
Ed Sheeran and ELO, you know, sort of like not something that anyone was necessarily expecting, you know, literally, you know, Beyonce, who was not announced before the show, you know, that was a surprise performance by Beyonce before John Legend and Common. So I thought there were a lot of moments, and that's really part of the team, and, you know, the whole team.
Can you defend or explain, or you have to answer for the awards, of course. You don't vote on the awards. Do you have a voting in the Grammys, by the way?
I don't vote. I don't. I'm not. And I've chosen not to vote in that. I don't really want to be a have already taken sides.
I'm wondering if there was any laughter about Tenacious D winning Best Metal Performance. It seems like a win alongside Jethro Tull. But maybe it's a great track. I haven't listened to it.
I would vote Tenacious D for MacArthur Genius Foundation Fellowship. I love Tenacious D, ironically and unironically.
Yeah, they're kind of both a good musical band, and they're also very funny, and it's kind of interesting they won for I guess, what was it?
Heavy metal performance.
Yeah.
Listen, I know a lot of heavy metal bands that are funny, but they don't mean to be. So I love Tenacious D.
So what was the happy surprise for you last night? Whether it was a performance or someone delivering something you wrote in the right way, or a win that you were really pleased by?
Oh, I loved George Ween, you know, this great jazz promoter, festival sort of creator. He was trending around the world, and he's, you know, 89, I believe it was, and just for, you know, his spirit, he was, you know, everyone giving him that kind of warm embrace. That was a moment for me. You know, I had the perfect, charming storm of having to get Miley Cyrus and Nicki Minaj and Madonna all happy with an introduction.
the fact that we pulled that off and everyone behaved, you know, more or less, I will rest easier tonight.
I thought
the Katy Perry performance with the introduction by that amazing young woman, I thought she was so powerful to me. The president was pretty good too. I think musically, there's just moments I love, I love the old pros who still have it. Tony Bennett was just here rehearsing for this TV show. I love Tony Bennett singing with Gaga. I love Sir Tom Jones, who I'd never met before this week. And I thought he was phenomenal. Singing with Jesse J.
Well, and you mentioned that the woman who spoke on domestic violence, she kind of gave a little, she gave a little essay before Katy Perry sang. That was one of those moments I thought, okay, so this is the moment that everybody's talking about. Much like, by the way, and you should be proud of this, everybody's talking about Nicki Minaj and Miley Cyrus introducing Madonna and how that went off quite well. As you say, it could have gone south pretty fast, and it went well. What was certainly domestic violence has been in the news a lot lately due to the NFL and a number of other issues. What was the thinking there of bringing it into the Grammys?
It was a discussion. I mean, I think you've seen increasingly sort of social conscience in the Grammys, you know, from our marriages last year at the Grammys to this was an idea that Ken Ehrlich had in talking to Katie and talking to the White House and then trying to find the right messenger of it on stage, trying to introduce it in a different way. And I thought it was really powerful. And I think, especially Katy Perry, it's like, this was not the Super Bowl Katy Perry. This was a whole different moment. And I find it, you know, it's great when the show can be about something and reflect something. You know, it's like, Prince is normally a man of few words. So I basically wrote him some lines like, you know, albums matter then and now, kind of, you know, albums still matter, you know. And then he added Black Lives and books, which I thought was the most brilliant co-write I've ever had with Prince. I'll never have a better co-write. If he generally wants to say, you know, it's like, give me three words. I'll say three words. So I love that. I think he was phenomenal. I worship him musically, so that was great. A lot of highlights, but now we're going to make. I will tell you for all that, the open of the Stevie Wonder show that's going to be filmed tomorrow is maybe my favorite thing I've ever seen. So you have to always be working on the next one.
Well, and that airs on February 16th. Well, I don't think we could hear you when you said that before. That airs February 16th on CBS. So that's a week from Monday.
Yep, a week from today. Yes.
Well, certainly, I think that more and more people are caring about the Grammys every single year. Whatever the ratings are, I know every year it is one of the award shows everybody's looking forward to, everybody's waiting for, and certainly the next day and for weeks and months, if not years to come, we're all talking about the performances. And it's always great to speak with you afterwards to find out how the show was put together and what the concerns were, what the trials and tribulations were, not only as you're putting on the Grammys, but more and more, all these tribute shows that you do in the days to come.
Yeah, last year's show, you know, that was the challenge of honoring the Beatles, of trying to do something that would be worthy of them. That was one thing. Won Emmys, and that we know I got an Emmy nomination, and we were proud of it. This one, I think, is going to be just as special. So, yeah, that's, I hope everyone will tune in. I hope I live to watch it next week.
David, thank you. Always a pleasure to speak with you. We'll put all of your contact information, your Twitter information in the show notes. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks a lot. Well, I know he's busy. That was good of him to stop by. Certainly, I the night started off as a bummer for me because they released all the pre-broadcast Grammy wins, and I found out that Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings did not win. They lost out to Toni Braxton and Babyface for Best R&B Album, so I was bummed about that. But Beck is one of my favorite albums of the year, so I'm glad it won the Album of the Year overall.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly there's no controversy over it. I did not mean to. It's very hard when we have people in remote places and, you know, he's working at the Staples Center, David is. And so it's hard to.
The sound quality wasn't great on that one.
Yeah, it was hard to convey a point. Look, it's great for him to speak with us. I'm happy, you know, we were able to arrange it. We were Twittering back and forth and texting back and forth just to arrange it. It was very good of him to stop by.
Absolutely. And in the show notes, I have to say there were a fair number of winners at the Grammys that are on my list of the best albums of the year, which I did just post the weekend before the Grammys. That's my annual tradition. I force myself to finish up and, you know, cut bait and, you know, make a decision about what my favorites are right now. And we've got in the show notes, we've got a list of my top 10 and a link to my blog where you can find a list of about the 40 favorite albums I had from 2014 and all my favorite albums of all time for every year.
Wow, so you've narrowed it down to 40.
For the year.
For the year, okay.
Well, what do you mean? That's pop and soul and country and jazz and blues and gospel and hip-hop and world music and soundtrack and cast albums. That's 40's not that much. If you're looking at just country, if you're a country fan, I've probably got 7 or 8 albums on there. Is that so much from all of music and country? You know, there's a wealth of music that gets created in the world these days. So, you know, but my top 10 list is on our website in the show notes, and that is Kaiser Chiefs. That's my favorite album of the year.
Oh, wow.
Education, 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 and war. And then country artist Sturgill Simpson with Metamodern Sounds and country music. R&B artist Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings for Give the People What They Want. Bones, who's a rapper who gives away his music for free. You don't even have to pay for it. And number 5 is Beck with Morning Phase. So there you go.
And Sam Smith not on there at all.
Nope, no, he's not. It was a pretty good album. I like the song a lot. If I was listening to my favorite songs of the year, Stay With Me, especially in the duet version with Mary J. Blige, would be on there. But it did not make my list of the best albums of the year.
Well, and Sam Smith did win, what did he win? He won like Song of the Year and Record of the Year.
Song of the Year, Record of the Year, Best New Artist, and Best Pop Vocal Album.
And yeah, wow, okay. So that's pretty much it for the Grammys. I guess when you put it that way, Michael, when you mention all of those genres of music, I guess 40, that's not so bad.
That's it's a big deal. You know, there's a lot of music to talk about, and so therefore, there's a lot of music to list.
Oh, I see what you just did there. You're trying to move us into Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, let me ask you this, Michael. What do you think, I mean, that song Glory by Common and John Legend, that was not nominated for a Grammy, was it?
It's not eligible yet.
Right. Okay, so yet they were performing it on this year's Grammy just as the Oscar ballots go out for the final voting for the Oscars. That song is nominated for an Oscar. So you know how in political campaigns they say, well, if you give 5 minutes to candidate A, you have to give 5 minutes to candidate B on your television network. You know, here they allowed that song to be and kind of booked that song for the closing of the Grammys. And it was a great moment and, you know, lovely song. But yet, do you think it gives that song an edge in the Oscars?
Any public visibility helps. Sure, why not?
Do you think it will affect the final Oscar voting? Maybe that's the question I should ask.
Affect? No. If the song is popular and gets performed and seen a lot, of course it has a better chance of winning. You know, was Let It Go helped by being a smash hit? Of course.
Okay. Well, then it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment. And we tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the Fox hit Empire is in the top 10 with a bullet. Now, that's a music thing, so I guess that's... You get it there, Michael?
I get it.
That's, yeah, it's music industry terms for a hit song that is still growing in sales and airplay. That's certainly true for the soap opera set in the music business, Empire. For the fourth week in a row, Empire has risen in the ratings. The last show to do that was the first season of the reality stalwart Survivor.
Well, I know Survivor did it for 3 weeks in a row. I don't know if they did it for four. They may have, but I don't have that info.
Well, it aired in the summer opposite repeats, so maybe that helped it. I don't know. That was still a big achievement back then, so you can imagine how it looks when a show airs against tough competition and goes up 4 weeks in a row. In other TV news, The Walking Dead may have finally peaked with a 15 to 16 million viewers tuning in. The mid-season premiere was the first one not to set a record in key demographics. Its lead out, Better Call Saul, set a basic cable record for a series premiere with 6.9 million viewers in the overnights. We were just talking about that, Michael, with David Wilde. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I mean, Empire to grow 4 weeks in a row, and now it's bringing attention to Terrence Howard's personal life, where he's got some allegations and actual charges of assault. That's the new hot button issue. You know, you've got a history of assault. An ex-wife got a restraining order against him. He's accusations and things weren't always filed. In 2013, his second wife had a second restraining order against him. In 2001, he was arrested for a variety of charges. He pled guilty to disturbing the peace. You know, it's ugly stuff. And you want to, you know, that becomes toxic. Is that the new hot button issue where, hey, you're involved in domestic violence, we don't want you on our TV shows, we don't want you as a celebrity, we don't want you as a star? Obviously, the network didn't deal with it or think about it or think it was an issue when they cast him. Now it's sort of an issue.
Well, I read about this news involving Terrence Howard a while back and never could really make heads or tails of it. And certainly more has come out about the past allegations. Who knows what'll happen? He's on a hit TV show now. That doesn't excuse any previous behavior or future behavior.
But it makes the studio less likely to want to clamp down on him.
That's true.
Maybe he'll do a PSA, or maybe he'll take some more substantive change to address it. I certainly hope so.
I agree. Now, celluloid lives. Yes, the rumors of the demise of film on actual film have been greatly exaggerated.
That's what Quentin Tarantino says.
Well, not exactly greatly exaggerated. Celluloid is still around, but it's more like The Walking Dead than a living, breathing success story. The latest twist is that Kodak has worked out a deal with the major studios. They commit to purchasing a certain amount of celluloid over a span of years so that Kodak can justify keeping its celluloid factory open and running. It's more like a co-op than a business deal, with everyone working together to make it happen.
Now, that's beautiful.
Now Kodak will reach out to some top indies to share the burden as well. To put it all in perspective, Kodak's film sales have collapsed 96% over the last decade. Big deal or big whoop?
Wow. It seems like a big deal because some filmmakers still want to shoot in film. You look at this year's Oscar nominees, Boyhood, The Grand Budapest Hotel, The Imitation Game, Interstellar, Foxcatcher, and Into the Woods were all shot on film. Boyhood had to be, because it practically started before digital existed.
That's what I was going to say. There was a reason for that with Boyhood.
Upcoming movies, Star Wars Episode 7, for very good artistic reasons. The new Mission Impossible, Batman versus Superman, Jurassic World, Ant-Man, Cinderella, Entourage, and Trainwreck are all being shot on film. So, hey, if you want to shoot on film, you better do something to allow Kodak to stay in business as far as making film stock. And thank God they've stepped up and done it.
Well, they are one of the, if not the only film stock manufacturer around. I'm sure there's others still, you know, here and there, but nowhere near as large as Kodak. And in Los Angeles, there's only one lab, motion picture lab, left that can even process the footage. So
wow.
This is for capture. And this news is actually the announcement and culmination of a deal that began way back in August of last year, and we reported on it then that they were going to do this, and it seemed like a done deal then, but apparently they had to work some things out, and now they have. Now, actor Michael Gambon has also worked some things out.
The great Gambon.
Yes, he's announced he's retiring from the theater. The 74-year-old actor says he simply doesn't have the short-term memory anymore. He memorizes his lines, but then struggles to recall them on stage. What are we talking about, actually?
He's retiring from the theater. He can't remember his lines anymore.
Well, that's every actor's nightmare, of course, but one that often comes with age to all. I think it's coming to me all the time. But Gambon is, of course, one of the most acclaimed actors of our time. He's known by many for his role as Professor Dumbledore in most of the Harry Potter films, but he also starred in the landmark TV miniseries The Singing Detective, the crime fighter Magritte. Is that how you pronounce that, Michael?
Oui.
In Robert Altman's Gosford Park, and more great stage work than you can shake a stick at, such as David Hare's Skylight and in Pinter's The Caretaker. At Pinter's request, Gambon read a monologue at the playwright's funeral, in fact. Nicknamed the Great Gambon by, well, Michael and, of course, Ralph Richardson, he will continue to work in film and television, but has taken his final bow in theater. Big yeller, big whoop.
Oh, it's very sad. I mean, I love Gambon. I really do. He's such a great actor. And actually, I saw him in his last performance in New York. He performed with Eileen Atkins in an adaptation of a radio play called After the Fall. And he actually struggled a little bit with his lines. And you see this sometimes with the older actors. And you think, oh, you know, you want to see them still on the stage whenever you can. But you want them to exit gracefully as well. And I think he's done that just right on the edge there. I've seen some people, I think, oh, you really, this is, you should just hang it up. And it's very sad to see. It happens to us all, I guess, eventually. But thank God he can still act on film and television.
Well, I saw Angela Lansbury recently out here in Los Angeles in Blithe Spirit, and she was great. Did she struggle with her lines? Yes, but I don't think it was from memory. I think it was more that she was talking so fast that her body couldn't keep up with how fast she wanted to say the words.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, she wanted her character to say them faster, but her body was like, you do know you're in your 80s, right?
Well, that's an acclaimed production. She's been touring with that for a while, and if you get a chance to see her, please do. Was it good?
Yes, it was great, and she was amazing. I was shocked at how good she was.
Oh, well, she's a great stage actress.
No, I know, but I mean, you know, heck.
You mean her age?
Yeah, if I'm half as mobile as she is at her age, I'll be very, very happy.
And how did your kids like Billy Elliot?
They thought it was great. They did want to know about all that cursing.
Was there a lot of cursing in it?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Oh, I don't remember that.
Yeah, and I tried to explain. You see, kids.
It's cute when they say it with a British accent.
Yes. And
it's not cute if you say it.
You see, this was a long time ago, and people don't use those words anymore. And you see, they were not educated, and they were minors. So they're using uneducated words, and therefore.
Nice try. That's a load of shite, Dad. That's what they said.
Yes. Oh, my arse.
My arse? Are you worried about arse? You should encourage them to say arse. Do they want to take ballet lessons?
No.
Okay.
It's funny, though. Now, speaking of people who might need to hang it up, Brian Williams lied repeatedly about being on a helicopter in Iraq that was shot down under fire. Bizarrely, Williams took a soldier to a New York Rangers game as a thank you, and the public address announcer stated why. The soldier was responsible for Williams' safety when their helicopter was shot down in Iraq.
Not so much.
A soldier on Facebook commented, huh? Stars and Stripes investigated, and Williams sort of apologized, saying the fog of memory rather than the fog of war.
Not the fog of war.
Yeah, see that?
The fog of... Michael Gambon could tell him something about that. Yes, I've my memory is going, but I still remember whether I've been shot down or not over Iraq.
Right. Well, he said that fog of memory had him conflate what happened 12 years ago, and he apologized profusely. The problem is that Williams has told the story of being under fire and shot down many times, including on David Letterman's Late Show, but his apology makes it seem as if he just misremembered it more than a decade after the fact. Mind you, most people don't get confused as to whether they were shot down, as you mentioned, Michael, in a helicopter over Iraq. Given the outcry over his apology, NBC has now launched an internal investigation, and Williams has taken a break from his on-air role as anchor of the NBC Evening News. Big deal or big whoop?
Big deal.
Huge deal.
A couple things. One, we had to keep adding to this story.
I know.
I was like, that's not a good apology. I heard his apology and he said, that's not a good apology. That's a bunch of malarkey when he said, oh, I've just misremembered what happened 12. No. That's not the way to apologize and end the story. So that was bad. And I thought, that's not good. And then they said, oh, and they got an investigation. And then the next day, he's stepping down, not in his involvement with the show as editor, but just as the on-air role of anchor. So this is a big mess. I can't understand why it took a decade to come out. He's been telling this story for years. Why the soldiers who weren't on the helicopter with them, on the plane with him, that was an hour behind the one that was shot down, by the way. It's not like they were 10, you know, first it was, oh, we were near them and then we were on it and then we were shut down. It was like an hour behind the other helicopter.
Actually, the report there, the hour behind thing, is they were traveling in formation. The helicopter in front of the one that that
well, an Williams hour was, behind.
No, the person, the soldier on Facebook said, "I don't remember you being on my helicopter. I do right. recall you 1 hour later coming yes. up to me to see if I was okay."
Yes, yes, I know. Yes, I've heard that, but no, he was not. He was not near a helicopter that was even taken down. They were not standing next to a helicopter that was taken down. It was nowhere near it. That's my understanding.
Well, if you see the report, his helicopter was shot with bullets. The other helicopter, at the end of the day, his helicopter wasn't shot down. That's really what matters.
No, well, it's dramatically different if the helicopter next to you explodes in flames and you survive, or you're quite a ways away from the helicopter that was shot down and show up later and go, "Oh, what happened?" You don't say what happened if you're there visibly watching them being shot down. So no, his helicopter, I believe, was nowhere near in the vicinity of the helicopter that was shot down.
The report from 2000...
I know the quote from that other guy, but that does not mean he was...
No, for the 2003 report... Or whenever.
Well, again, all these reports are lies. So what we need is an actual investigation. And apparently the soldiers have been angry for years about him keep repeating this story. Why it never came out before is astonishing to me. But why did it come out? Why is Bill Cosby in trouble? Social media. A yes. guy on social media said, "Huh? Like, dude, you were not on my helicopter when we were shot down." And that is what Stars and Stripes picks up on and investigates. And that's why this has all come to the fore. But is it a big deal for Brian Williams?
I think it is. I think the only thing you have going for you in a role like that is that your objectivity and your trustworthiness, and he has lost both.
And yet he hasn't, because what would matter to me a lot more is what he does on the news. If he lied about a story, if he repeated a story on the news, or his journalism was in question here, I would think it would be a lot more damaging to his credibility as an anchor and a reporter and a journalist. But we're not talking about his work as a journalist. He didn't repeat on the news this story as a factual story. This is something he did on the side in entertainment situations on Letterman. It doesn't mean lying about it is any better, but he didn't do it in his role as a journalist. It's not like Doris Kearns Goodwin plagiarizing from other journalists. It's not like a journalist making up a whole, source for a story. This has nothing to do with his journalism. So to me, I think that's a big difference.
And I agree with you. It is social media. I can't remember the New York Times reporter who basically made up all of his stories about,
Jason Blair.
Jason Blair, but there was another person who I thought did that, where basically...
Well, there was a woman who made up a huge kid addicted to heroin or something like that.
Well, whatever the case, I mean, those people wound up having fictional stories, reporting them as news, not even in the same city that they were supposedly reporting on, and they got fired. And I thought, if this guy gets fired for this, where's the justice in that? You can either create a huge infraction like Jason Blair and get fired, or you can exaggerate what happened and get fired in a non-journalistic sense. I agree with you is what I'm saying.
Right. It's not well, but this is there's I say it doesn't affect his credibility as a journalist as much as it might if it was him faking a story or doing something in journalism. It still hurts his credibility. And this is a business decision. If people say, "I don't want to watch him on the nightly news anymore because I don't like him," he's out of luck.
Right.
So that's the problem.
Well, and I heard one person who is a vet actually say, "Look, speaking for certain vets and most vets, which one of us hasn't exaggerated a story of our frontline activity?"
Well, I don't know. The story of the vets in World War II is they didn't talk about it at all. So
yes.
I don't think everybody runs around lying about their service. I think a lot of people don't.
Okay. Well, no, I can't speak either way. Not a vet. What can I say? What I could say is I'm really shocked. I'm really shocked that Harper Lee is actually going to publish another book. She's only written the one book, To Kill a Mockingbird. And now I guess they'll deliver a sequel to just about anything in news that, like I said, it's at the very least, it's surprising. Author Harper Lee, famed for having published the only one book, To Kill a Mockingbird, has a new book coming out in July. The 88-year-old author, who doesn't speak to the media and has written barely a word since To Kill a Mockingbird, apparently wrote the new book before she wrote her classic work. So the novel called Go Set a Watchman is actually a sequel of sorts, or maybe it's a prequel, I don't know, since it takes place 20 years after the events of To Kill a Mockingbird and takes place as an adult scout deals with segregation and her conflicted feelings over the South. Apparently, an editor was enamored with some flashbacks and urged Lee to develop a story around Scout as a kid. That led to the work she's famous for, and this novel was kind of set aside, forgotten and presumed lost, frankly. The manuscript was recently found and will be published without any editing or changes. Bad idea. In other news, the late J.D. Salinger has a trilogy of books coming out in August. Big deal or big whoop?
It's not a bad idea. It's. I'm sure they cleaned it up for typos, but they don't want to say we're editing this book now because she's not, I don't think she's in a place to work with them on editing it or writing it. And they don't want to claim, oh, this is her new work. They want to say, hey, this happened. This is sort of the father of To Kill a Mockingbird. To Kill a Mockingbird is a sequel or a prequel to what this book is. It was written first. And a great editor said, you know what? The strength of this book are the flashbacks. Go back and write a whole story set in the flashbacks. And that's what she did. And it turned out a masterpiece. So there's a lot of back and forth about how much she approves of this. And her people are very touchy. They're like, how dare you question? It's like, well, she doesn't talk to anyone. Nobody talks to her. And we only get statements from her through her lawyer slash friend. So of course.
Yeah. You can say that the trend here is that she will not be publishing another book after umpteen years of not publishing another book. And given that she's never written another book.
We don't know if she's pulled a Salinger.
Right.
She may have been writing all this time, but we don't have any sense that she did.
Yeah. It seems a little fishy that you may be taking advantage of an 88-year-old woman.
Well, I don't say that it's fishy that they're taking advantage. I'm just saying, don't question us when we wonder why or how. You know, like for 50, 60 years, she said, no, I'm done. And suddenly she's doing it. But she said, oh, I wrote it first. It's okay. But if an actual person from the media spoke to her rather than intermediaries, there'd be far less question. Surely someone from the New York Times could go chat with her. She's 88. Her friends and close people say, oh, no, she's sharp as a tack. Well, then let her talk to somebody.
No fog of memory there.
Right, exactly. So, you know, it's that they could clear this up and they've had to go back and forth and give multiple statements from her and her lawyer's given more of an interview, but it's not going to go. Nobody's going to know. The only thing that will clear it up is if it's actually really good.
Yes.
You know, that will reassure people. Okay, you know what? This is a valid work. We're happy. If it's sort of like, you know, then that will make people think, yeah, it probably should never have come to light and she probably didn't know about it. And to say we're insulting her by saying she doesn't approve it, well, we haven't heard from her. A statement through her lawyer does not count. There was that woman who wrote a book, The Next Door Neighbor, a journalist who moved in next door, befriended Harper and her sister for years, and then wrote a memoir about it. She says Harper Lee approved of it. It goes against the 40, 50 years of history that we know of, but... You know, on the one hand, we have one people saying, oh, no, she absolutely doesn't. And the other hand, we have other people saying, oh, no, of course she does. But we didn't hear from her. So we don't know.
You know one thing we do know?
What?
Rosie O'Donnell is leaving.
No, you blew it.
The daytime chat. What do you mean I blew it?
You blew it. You blew the joke. Rosie's leaving. We've been saying Rosie would leave for weeks.
Oh, I see. You actually.
But it's not. Yeah.
Wait, Rosie. I said Rosie O'Donnell. You said Rosie. Oh, I see. The joke here is that Rosie actually is leaving the daytime chat fest of you.
That's right. Rosie O'Donnell, that is, not Rosie Perez.
I see. You see, this is what happens when you do a cold read of a joke. That's right. Timing really is everything. Well, it turns out Rosie O'Donnell's leaving the show in a week to deal with family issues after splitting with her wife of just over 1 year.
And medical issues and something else. It's always big drama for Rosie.
Yes. Reports say it wasn't the two Rosies feuding so much as O'Donnell and Whoopi Goldberg both feeling they were in charge. Ratings are flat despite all the changes. New bosses are in charge and presumably more changes will be coming as they try to figure out life post-Barbara Walters. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. Woman walks away from job and a couple million bucks. It's a shame. I thought she would really help the show when she came back, but she didn't come back in the role that she had, which was the moderator of the issues. She seemed tamped down. She was unhappy. She's got, you know, issues in her personal life. Nothing's going well. The whole Rosie Perez, you know, fracas. it's just not a good time. So very bungled introduction of Rosie O'Donnell and Rosie Perez, bungled transition from the entertainment to the news side, now a bungled exit with Rosie O'Donnell leaving. It's just been a mess all around. But I was wrong again. I thought she would really boost the ratings and bring extra attention to the show, and it didn't work out that way.
Wait, I'm going to actually cut that part out and have it in a cart so that we can always just kind of as a sound effect.
I was wrong.
Again.
Again.
But that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, let's face it, they affect everybody. Everybody that's listening to this particular show, which was delivered to you over the internet, they definitely affect you. Because we've been following this net neutrality fracas for who knows how long, way too long, frankly, according to Mr. Tom Wheeler, the head of the FCC, the chairman of the FCC, for more than a decade. And he has, and we all kind of owe Mr. Wheeler an apology, maybe, because we weren't very nice to him.
No, because he had bad proposals that got a lot of pushback from people who said they were dumb, poorly thought out, wouldn't hold up in a court of law, and were bad for the industry.
Well, and remember, Tom Wheeler is in the Hall of Fame for the National Cable Television Association and for the wireless group, Cydia. And
it shows.
And he kind of came out and said, well, I don't see what the problem is with paid prioritization. That's why, those groups actually had me hired as the FCC. What?
Yeah, no, we don't owe him an apology. We did our job of holding his feet to the fire. And the president did as well when he wasn't doing his role to do what was best for the American consumer. And he wasn't. And he would have gotten away with it if people didn't shine a spotlight on what he did. If bloody John Oliver hadn't done a video,
John Oliver called him. He said, "Would you leave your baby with a dingo?" No. And yet we've hired this guy to manage the internet.
Yeah, no, he doesn't deserve an apology. He's doing this, what he's been forced to do, and then he's leaving, probably back to a cushy paid job back in the cable industry.
Well, okay. Before we get into what happened, my conspiracy theory. He wrote this op-ed piece for Wired magazine.
Oh, we don't care about the op-ed. He
said, basically, in this, which is what these recommendations are. These are official recommendations which the FCC can approve, and then once approved, they kind of become kind of they're not a law, but they're a regulation, so to speak. He said that he believed originally that the FCC could assure internet openness through kind of these commercial reasonableness, that these entities, these business entities...
We don't care about his reasoning. But basically, what did they do? What did the FCC do? What did they propose?
Well, this is the thing. The way he words this is important.
Well, not because he's leaving.
Yeah, in 2 years. Okay? But he is proposing that the FCC use its Title II authority to implement and enforce open internet protections. This is what Obama called for. He says, using this authority, I'm submitting to my colleagues the strongest open internet protections ever proposed by the FCC. These enforceable bright line rules will ban paid prioritization and the blocking and throttling of lawful content and services.
Nobody's for unlawful content and services.
Just let me finish. I propose to fully apply for the first time ever those bright line rules to mobile broadband. My proposal assures the rights of internet users to go where they want, when they want, and freedom of the internet. He then goes on to say, to preserve incentives for broadband operators to invest in their networks, my proposal will modernize Title II, tailoring it for the 21st century in order to provide returns necessary to construct competitive networks. For example,
in English.
Okay. Just follow me here. For example, there will be no rate regulation, no tariffs, no last mile unbundling. And he points out that the cell phone industry operated under the same rules, Title II regulation, and so you can make $300 billion that way. Okay, so in English...
And he's responding to companies like Verizon that recently said, oh, we're selling off this landline stuff that we have because of this new... internet rules. We can't deal with this net neutrality. It's a disaster. Meanwhile, they were planning to sell it off for like 3 years. It was in the works. So the idea that this new ruling suddenly means they have to sell it off is malarkey.
Right. And what he's saying is, hey guys, you know the rules that you say right now that you're following these commercially reasonable rules. mm-hmm. and you're no paid prioritization. You
There's no need to make it official.
Yeah. You're saying you're following it anyway. So what we'll do is we'll take this big giant sledgehammer called Title II. We'll back out a lot of the really strenuous stuff that you all hate, like rate regulation, where we, the government, tell you how much you can charge. Charge whatever you want.
Which is what happens with real utilities.
Yes, that is what happens with real utilities. That right. is correct. Yes, they're owned by the municipalities, and there's some rate regulation going on there. He's saying, no, there is no rate regulation. In fact, you don't even have to share the lines. You can still have monopolies. That's what last mile unbundling means. That means that it used to be you could only put an AT&T phone onto an AT&T line. What he's saying is, no, you can run the line. Others may, you may kind of wholesale it to others if you wish. If not, you're still going, you're the only ones laying.
So your conspiracy theory is that he seems to be doing what is best for the public and doing what the president wants him to do and caving to public popular pressure. But in fact, he's giving a little big goodbye gift to the cable and telecommunications industry.
Well, yes and no. The whole last mile unbundling, it's kind of what we all want because that would actually improve competition. That would mean even though one company lays the wire into your house, any company can use it. That's kind of what we have with telephones. If AT&T puts the line in, then MCI or Sprint or anybody can come in and, you know, take over. My conspiracy theory here is, first of all, this is exactly what everybody wanted. Okay, Title II, everybody was scared of. He says,
"Well, let's say it's like it's a step towards what we want. We have a philosophical goal that needs to be met by ever-changing rules and regulations. There's no one rule you put in place and then we're done." Right. So, no, there's a philosophical goal to reach. This is one step, perhaps, towards it.
Correct. And I think that, you know, he used something called forbearance to say all of these rules that are kind of too onerous for Title II for you guys, we're going to take those out. So it's really just open internet, no paid prioritization, no blocking, no throttling. Okay, just do that, which you say you're doing already anyway, and everything else is the same. What I think is that the only thing that can override one of these regulations is, guess what? A law. And who runs Congress right now? Republicans, who have always kind of felt that Title II was not that whole party, that whole most of the politicians in that party have felt Title II was not the way to go here. So he's doing this knowing full well that there's a backstop in Congress who could just overrule all of this. Now, I think Congress does so at their own peril, because even Tom Wheeler saw which way the wind was blowing on this issue.
You think Congress is going to pass a new law to overdo this? This wildly popular, both liberals and conservatives, everybody wants this. And you think Congress is going to pass a law that will pass a presidential veto?
No.
It's not going to happen.
No.
So that's not a conspiracy.
Darn.
He's not worried about what Congress does.
I wanted to start my own conspiracy.
We'll have to work harder.
Darn.
Well, so it's a good step forward. Do you think there are any loopholes that we should be worried about?
Yes. Now, here's the reason you heard me kind of pause on some of these things is lawful content. Okay, what he's saying here is we're not going to step in the way of copyright owners who may want to go to ISPs and say, you better do deep packet inspection and start blocking BitTorrent and start blocking all of these pirated movies and television shows and music and books and everything.
Isn't that the case now?
No, that is the problem now.
He's opening the door for more blockage of pirated content.
Right. He's not necessarily opening the door because it's already open. He's leaving it open. He's saying, look, you can't block content, lawful content.
Okay. That's always been the case.
Yes.
Nobody says you can't block unlawful content. The question is who has to decide it's unlawful, who gets to decide that and when and how you put it in place.
Correct.
And nothing's changed there.
There is no rule for that because, you know, ultimately it's done automatically. Yeah. So that's where we stand on net neutrality right now. We'll see what happens. You know, they still have to vote on this, I think, the 26th of February. So we'll see if it's going to pass or not.
So paid prioritization is dead. Is anybody else dead this week?
Oh, you must be talking about our obituaries. And in this week, screenwriter Stuart Stern, unfortunately, sadly, passed away. He's the writer of Rebel Without a Cause.
You're not listening to me. You say one thing and you say another and you both twist it around. That's my Rebel Without a Cause quote.
Oh, I thought you were talking about our relationship.
That's James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause talking to his dad and his mom. Then he storms out of the house, grabbing some milk.
Yes. And for years, it was, you know, kind of parodied in certain movies and cartoons. Yes.
That's the best film Stern worked on, certainly the most memorable. He did some other stuff as well, didn't he?
Yeah, he did a TV movie, and I guess he won an Emmy for a TV movie, Sybil, which starred Sally Field. He died at the age of 92.
That's right. That was her big breakout role. He had a long relationship with Paul Newman. He did. He wrote the script for Rachel, Rachel, which was Newman's directorial debut, where he directed his wife, Joanne Woodward. He did Dennis Hopper's The Last Movie. That's pretty famous. And then in later years, he just stepped away from Hollywood and taught and oversaw and mentored people and died at 92. He also fought in the Battle of the Bulge.
And that wasn't recent, by the way.
No, that was World War II. So he's a World War II hero and the nephew of Adolf Zukor. Another example of a Hollywood person who had success despite the burden of being attached to somebody who was hugely successful before them.
Yeah, like me.
That's really?
No, I'm kidding. But you see,
if anybody successful wants to contact you.
Oh, look at the way, look at you just moving us right along here. I was going to say, you know, here we are teaching people about the heroes of yesteryear, the industry stars of yesteryear. But yes, if people do want to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle.
But not too close.
Yes, apparently not. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can subscribe to the show. We always love it when you subscribe and rate and review the show in iTunes, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher.
You haven't done it. Go on iTunes and press 5 stars. It just takes a second.
It does. And if everybody did it all at once, you know,
We would get picked up by Apple. We would get more visibility, and you become even cooler for knowing Showbiz Sandbox when it wasn't so well known.
That's true, and by not well known, we mean only like half the planet knows. You want to be you want to be before the other half figures it out. Now, all of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you're going to find all the links to that we discussed on today's show. All the links to David Wilde's work and David Wilde's social media contact info. At Wild About Music is his Twitter account. So I'd like to thank David Wild for joining us today to talk about the Grammys. It's always wonderful to speak with him. Again, all of this information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz, he has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
Sharon Jones was robbed.com.
Oh, I thought that might be a .gov, but no, .edu? No? Okay.
No.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's writing about the entertainment industry there, maybe try the Huffington Post, or you can run on over to michaelgiltz.com, or bookfilter.com is another place to check out. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.